Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea here with Ryan Gibson. How are you, man?
Good to see you, Tate. How was the conference?
Good to see you. Yeah, sat 7 hours in a 7-6 jump seat yesterday getting home from Salt Lake. I was at the best ever real estate conference, sixth year running. I missed you, man. Where were you?
Busy back home.
That's fair.
Taking care of things in the back office. We've got a couple of deals that we're closing, so was keeping that up. We're closing a trio of properties here in the Pacific Northwest and breaking ground on a deal in Savannah, Georgia. So excited to get some more self-storage in the portfolio.
Incredible.
And I'm excited about today's guest, Brandon Hall, who's actually been in my network for the last decade or so. And I believe yours as well, Tate. And, you know, he's a CPA national speaker. He actually owns and is the founder of Hall CPA PLLC, which is a accounting firm, and they focus on real estate and tax. So he works with real estate investors, syndicators, private equity funds to optimize tax positions, streamline accounting, business functions, et cetera. And he's also the founder of the Real Estate CPA. He believes that real estate investing is critical to building sustainable and generational wealth. And he's worked, you know, he had a big corporate background and with PricewaterhouseCoopers and Ernst & Young before launching his own CPA firm. And I love his LinkedIn content. I love his approach to real estate and tax strategies. And I think our listeners are really going to enjoy the deep dive that we provide on the professional real estate tax status and how ministerial participation, how you get your spouse involved, and all these strategies. But Tate, I'll let you kind of give a little bit of background on that.
Yeah, real estate professional status is something that I've taken advantage of for many, many years. And I think it's the most powerful loophole in the tax code for high-income W-2 professionals. It's something that not everybody can qualify for. So if you're listening to this and you're just like, there's no way, you know, I don't have a spouse that can qualify. I can't qualify. I have no interest in managing my rentals. Maybe this episode's not for you, but maybe give it a listen because it might change your mind. The tax savings that you can get out of qualifying for real estate professional status are absolutely mind-blowing. So I've been sharing Brandon's ebook, which is a 30-something page document on all the nuances, the case law, all this stuff on real estate professional status for a really long time. So I'm really excited to have him on the show.
If you wait to the end, if you listen all the way to the end of the show, we'll tell you how you can get the 5 top tips for how pilots can save money on taxes. And we're going to tell you how you guys can get a copy of this ebook on becoming a real estate professional.
Yeah, it's a great ebook. And yeah, excited to talk to Brandon. So with that, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Brandon, thank you so much for coming on the show. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited to be here.
I tell you what, taxes are the number one pain point that pilots have to deal with.
Always.
I sat in the jump seat on Delta, thanks for the ride, yesterday for 7 hours. And we talked a lot about tax mitigation. And it blows people's minds when you start talking about real estate and the things that you can do to reduce your W-2 if you're doing things right and you're playing the game right. So you have an incredible ebook that I have shared with a lot of people because I think it's the best resource for real estate professional status that I've ever read.
Thanks.
And there are a lot of different topics that we could dive into today, but because you're such a consummate expert on the real estate professional status, that's what I really wanted to organize today's show around and do a really long, deep dive into real estate professional status, the case law around it, all that stuff. So without further ado, Brandon, maybe you could give some background on yourself, how you got into being a CPA.
Sure. So thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. I run a firm called Hall CPA PLLC. We are also known as the Real Estate CPA. We've got about 800 clients across the United States. Every single one of them invests in real estate. You know, it's interesting too. I coach CPA firms on like how to run CPA businesses. And one of them asked me is like, so you just do the real estate piece. You don't do anything else. And I was like, actually, I guess we're not niched in real estate like I thought we were. We've got tons of businesses that we serve in like all sorts of different industries and areas. But the commonality is every single one of our clients is investing in real estate. So we work with clients across the United States. My team, we've got about like 55 people now all across the United States as well. 100% remote firm. I started it back in 2016. I was trying to get out of my corporate job and I was buying rental real estate myself, trying to, you know, do the passive income, build wealth, all that stuff. And then through that process, realized there were a lot of landlords asking tax questions. I was like, oh, I could potentially help with this. And it just sort of snowballed into what it is today. So that's how I got here. But it's been a lot of fun. I mean, I've been able to see kind of behind the scenes of extremely successful real estate investors who have built very, very large net worth. And you get to kind of asking them about how they did it. It's definitely like real estate's a multi-decade game. But I also learned like the most successful people in real estate are running it like a business. So it's not like because I came into it, like, oh, I'm going to passively invest on the side, and you can be really successful doing that. But if you're talking about like the echelons of net worth, I mean, these guys are just grinding on it every single day. So it's been fascinating. It's been a lot of fun networking and meeting all these really successful people.
That's incredible.
What do you think it's been the biggest takeaway? When you say operating real estate like a business, what do you think has been the biggest takeaway on operating a regular business or just operating it? You know, what are the details in how that makes it different?
I think that our most successful clients are always looking at ways to add value, and they're always looking for arbitrage opportunities. So, you know the saying, like, you make money when you buy. That either has to be true, or you have to be really good at adding value. So you've got to be really good at finding great deals, or you have to be really good at adding value so that you can arbitrage that value. That's what our most successful clients do. Now, we have a ton of clients that have high income jobs, and they're investing in real estate on the side, and they're very successful too. I think that the difference though is that, you know, they buy kind of on the cash flow, and then they realize later, oh, the cash flow just kind of carried the property for that appreciation bump, especially those of us that have been owning over the past 3 years, right? We just saw massive increases in value. So then when you see that, like, well, then the cash flow isn't even really that big of a deal.
Right.
So I think that's kind of the difference. It's just the most sophisticated people on our client base create that value consistently. And then the higher income earners that like have jobs or run businesses like myself, when we invest in real estate, we kind of wait for the value to be created by the market. And I think that's the main difference.
Right. Well, that definitely resonates with, you know, guys like Ryan and I, where we're, you know, Ryan owns a syndication firm. We're a fund where we partner with operators like Ryan. And these people are really good at rolling up their sleeves and creating that value, and they run it like a business. So that definitely resonates with us. You know, real estate makes money in four ways, right? And that's something, I don't know if we've touched on this on the show, but it makes money through, of course, cash flow, appreciation, amortization, meaning that the overall time, you know, the loan gets paid down and you build equity. And of course, depreciation, which is the tax benefits that are associated with it. So let's start with depreciation. For people that aren't familiar with how real estate gets depreciated and why you can depreciate something that actually increases in value over time, and then we can get into how we can leverage that against other income.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's typically where we start with new investors, because new investors are like, why would I depreciate this thing that's supposed to appreciate? So depreciation is a non-cash expense that you get to claim every single year. And it's meant to track the deterioration of your asset over time. So it's true that when you buy real estate, it increases in market value, but it's also true that the roof literally falls apart, the windows literally fall apart, everything inside of it falls apart. So depreciation is meant to be an expense that tracks that deterioration year after year after year. And depreciation is it's a simple calculation. So I buy a property, let's just use simple numbers. I buy a property for $1 million. I have to make an allocation to land because dirt does not fall apart over time. So dirt cannot be depreciated. So let's say that 10% of my value goes to land. So now I've got $900,000 of improvements or building value. I just divide that by 27 and a half years, and that's my annual depreciation expense. And it doesn't matter if I 100% financed the property, 100% bought cash, went 70-30, 50-50, whatever. So how I financed the acquisition doesn't matter. All that matters is what's my improvement value divided by 27 and a half years, or 39 years if we're talking about like office building commercial properties. So I just get to claim that annual expense every single year. And it's awesome because, you know, a lot of times rental real estate will produce net operating income, cash flow. But once you factor in depreciation, you actually have a taxable loss.
Right.
So there are a ton of examples in my own client base where, you know, our clients will be making $40,000 of cash flow, but they'll get to tell the IRS they lost $20,000 because they've got 60K depreciation that wipes the 40K out plus 20, right?
Right.
So you don't pay tax on the cash flow today, which is a huge tax benefit that continues to compound as you scale your portfolio. But you also have this tax loss that you might be able to take advantage of. And then that leads us back to the whole real estate professional status conversation that we were talking about at the beginning.
Excellent.
The objection that I always get with depreciation is, yeah, but I got to recapture that tax and pay it in the future. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I think that concern is well placed, because what happens is we get clients that just don't know about it or talk about it, and then they go to sell a property and they're shocked. So I do think that the conversation should be had. But I think that that a lot of people are overly concerned about it. So depreciation, it's an expense you get to claim today, but you do have to pay it back at some later point. And you pay it back through recapture. And a really simple way to think about this is, let's go back to that $1 million property. If I sold the $1 million property for $980,000, I bought it for $1 million, sold it for $980,000. Most of us would say, yeah, you lost $20,000 on it. But what an accountant is going to say is, well, what is your adjusted basis? And adjusted basis is my purchase price minus all the depreciation that I've claimed every single year. So if I've claimed 100K depreciation, my adjusted basis is $900,000. If I sell it for $980,000, I actually have an $80,000 gain. So even though I lost money on the books, I have an $80,000 gain. And that gain is created from depreciation. So that would be depreciation recapture. So depreciation recapture just depreciation reduces your adjusted basis. And then when you sell, it essentially inflates your gain that you have to pay tax on. But when you do the math, what you find is I got tax savings by taking the depreciation every single year. And then 7-10 years later, I had to pay the tax savings back.
When you pay the taxes at the sale, in your example, the 980, is it one for one? So like I saved a dollar in taxes and now I'm paying the dollar back? Or is there a potential arbitrage play there?
So it is kind of one to one, but it depends on the type of depreciation that we're talking about. So if you use bonus depreciation, like you're going to get tax savings at your current rate today, but you're going to pay it back at your current rate in the future. So it's not capped at the 25% rate like normal depreciation is. So if we're talking about bonus depreciation, we do recapture it at our regular tax rate. So if I'm in a high rate today, but I'm in a lower rate later, then yeah, I've got an arbitrage play right there, which is really nice. And then the same thing kind of works with straight line depreciation, where, you know, straight line depreciation, I'm going to take it today at my regular rate, but I'm going to recapture it at capital gain rates, which is also really nice, up to a maximum of 25%. So there is also an arbitrage opportunity.
Yeah, no, that's great. And when you say bonus depreciation, you're just talking about any of that 5 and 15 year short-term life, correct?
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool. Very good.
So let's jump into accelerated depreciation, right? Because this is something that a lot of real estate investors, or at least pilots that I run into, don't realize is that you can do something called a cost segregation study, pull certain components out of the building and accelerate their depreciation. And if you want a deep dive on cost seg, we did a great episode with Yona Weiss. Go back and listen to that. That's going to be the real deep dive on cost seg, but let's just touch on it here for somebody who hasn't listened to that episode, what a cost segregation is, what it accomplishes, and then we can sort of pile on bonus depreciation on top of that.
Yeah, so kind of continuing the conversation of when I buy a property, I'm depreciating it because components are falling apart, even though the property itself is increasing in value. A cost segregation study is the practice of basically like going through the property and identifying components that fall apart faster than 27 and a half years. So after a cost segregation study, you'll basically have value allocated to 5-year property, 7-year property, and 15-year property, as well as the 27.5-year property, the building. And then post cost segregation study, you can bonus depreciate any component with a useful life of less than 20 years. So, you know, you do a cost segregation study on a $1 million building, and you're probably looking at $200,000 of first year depreciation that you can claim. And you know, if that first year I had 40K in net operating income, then I'm looking at $160,000 tax loss. And that's where the tax benefits start to get really juicy.
Yeah. And to be clear, bonus depreciation was brought in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. 100% bonus depreciation. So anything you bought for the business with a 20-year life, basically, and real estate, you know, falls into this category. So if you pull anything out of that 27.5 year and you put it into one of these 5, 7, or 15 year categories, it's bonusable, right? And so it was 100% bonus depreciation, 2017 all the way through 2022. Last year we had 80%. This year we're at 60. Next year 40. The following year 20, and then it phases out in, what is it, 2027? However, yeah, there's a bill currently in the Senate that may bring it back. We want to touch on that?
We're hopeful. We're hoping that it would be passed by now, but I think that the chances of that are getting slimmer each day. So I don't know if that'll end up getting passed. I do think that something will change with bonus depreciation. I don't know if it's going to be retroactive to 2023 like we were all hoping for.
Understood.
I think we've all been waiting for interest rate cuts and tax change, and we're on pins and needles over here.
We are.
So
let's talk about the difference between passive and active losses. We talked about this with Toby Mathis back on episode 10. That's a great one if you want to go back to that. But talk about the wall that stands between passive income and passive losses, and active income and active losses, and why it's there, and how we can break it down.
Yeah, so rental activities are passive, and passive losses cannot offset non-passive income. So non-passive income is like W-2 income and business income. And also, interestingly enough, interest income and dividend income is all considered non-passive. So really, like, passive income, if you think about it, is just rentals. And then it's any business that you don't materially participate in, right? So if you guys came and, like, took a stake in my CPA firm and you didn't participate in my firm at all, you were just kind of capital partners, that would be passive income to you, that whatever income we pass back to you. So if you don't participate, or if you own rentals, that's all in the passive bucket. My non-passive bucket is my active, my ordinary income. The problem is that with Section 469, the passive activity loss rules, these rules were put in place to prevent people from using rental real estate to offset their regular income. So the problem is that rentals, because they're passive, the losses are passive, and passive losses just can't offset non-passive income. There are a few ways around it. You know, you can qualify as a real estate professional. You can earn less than $150,000. You could buy short-term rentals rather than long-term rentals. There's a few things that you can do. But in general, the idea is Congress does not want high-income taxpayers buying rentals to shield their regular income. So they make it difficult to do.
Right. So for anybody that gets to the end of this episode and they listen to all this real estate professional status stuff and they're like, yeah, there's no way I can pull that off, go look into the short-term rental stuff. If you buy an Airbnb and it's, you know, you self-manage, you do it less than 7 days, you can still take advantage of some of this cost segregation stuff. Let's dive into real estate professional. That's what I really, the meat that I want to get into here, because this is how you can knock down that wall and you can qualify as a real estate professional. And pilots are one of the only professions that you can pull this off, because we don't work 2,000 hours a year, right? We only work, you know, say 900 block hours. How do we knock down
that answer depends on who you're talking to, though.
That's true. That's true. That's true.
Are we in contract negotiations? Or are we talking to the IRS?
Very true. Very true. Before we jump into it, I just want to highlight why you should care, because, you know, I was talking to this flight crew yesterday in the jump seat, and you know, he was trying to wrap his head around it. I go, yeah, if you buy a $2 million property and you cost segregate it, you know, you could find a $400,000 or $500,000 loss. And if you're a real estate professional, you can apply that to your W-2 and you could pay no federal income tax for that. So I just want to set the stage there. Like, this is why you should care about this. So Brandon, over to you. What is real estate professional status? And then we can dive in from there.
Yeah, and that was a great example. I was actually going to ask, like, let's run through some numbers, but you did it. Okay, so real estate professional status. If you can qualify as a real estate professional, then your rentals become, and you have to materially participate in your rentals, but if you can qualify as a real estate professional and materially participate, then your rentals are non-passive. Now, that's the key, right? So we're basically moving our rentals out of this passive bucket of income, and we're putting it into the non-passive bucket where our W-2 income is. So especially good for pilots, right? We're flying and I'm making all this money, and now I can use rental losses to offset my income and not pay any federal taxes, and often not pay state taxes, though it does depend on the state. So very powerful. To qualify as a real estate professional, you have to spend 750 hours in real property trades or businesses. And you have to spend more time working in those real property trades or businesses than you work at your day job. So, and that second piece kicks out anybody with a full-time job, with the caveat of if your full-time job's not actually 2,000 hours of work a year, that's a little bit different, right? And so pilots have that. You guys are one of the only groups that I'm aware of that has that nice caveat there. Even the physicians that we talk to are like, well, I do 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. Does that matter? Like, no, because the 2 weeks on, you're working like 24-hour day shift.
Exactly. Right?
So, right. Yeah, you're still pulling 2K hours, if not more. But pilots, that's not the case. You can be full-time, but like you said, you're spending 900 hours. So if that's my fact pattern, if I fly for 900 hours, and you also have to I know that there's like other work that's not literally in the seat, right? So you have to log all that time that you spend. So let's just say 900 hours between just work and then being in the seat. If I spend 901 additional hours managing my rentals, I'm a real estate professional, and now I can use cost segregation studies, bonus depreciation to extract that depreciation from all my rentals, create large tax losses, and offset my income. And then obviously, if you offset your income with that, the tax savings that come with that, you know, we advise clients don't go buy a Ferrari, go roll it back in to more real estate or like the S&P or something, do something with it. Don't just spend it. But that's how it works in a nutshell.
Absolutely.
I think that's so powerful because as airline pilots, we're always looking for tax deduction opportunities. And there's literally hundreds of thousands of dollars that you can save by implementing some of these strategies that we talk about on the show all the time. And so by listening to Passive Income Pilots, I think people are getting this sense of, I actually have a lot of deductions that I can take, but they don't really know where to start. And we bring people onto the show like you to talk about these strategies and really help the flying community learn as much as they can about shielding taxes in a legitimate way and also growing their investment portfolio at the same time. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, no problem. It's if you can qualify as a real estate professional, the tax benefits are incredible. Now, the challenges to qualifying as a real estate professional are making sure that you log the appropriate time, right? So what happens with our clients is if you buy like a couple rentals, the acquisition time and the management time, it can add up. It can feel like a lot. But when you put it down onto a timesheet, you might go, oh, I only have like 100 hours here. So what do I do? And what we encourage clients to do is definitely not start inflating your time log, which a lot of clients do. Not our clients, but a lot of investors will do because they're really trying to hit that 750 hour threshold. So the key is to make sure, like if you're going to claim real estate professional status, to make sure that you learn what hours count and what hours don't count. And we infer this by looking at the Internal Revenue Code, looking at the Treasury regulations, and then also reading a ton of tax court cases that have come out on this stuff over time. So we know what counts, we know what doesn't count in terms of the hours that I log, what type of work I'm actually doing. But it's important to understand that because if you end up on the bad side of an audit, it's going to get pretty nasty pretty fast. And these audits have ticked up over the past 6 months, and the IRS is now implementing AI, and that's going to be helping them kind of pick what returns to examine. So I would expect this to be audited a little bit more frequently going forward as well. So it's really important to get the documentation right.
Two questions. One around logging. So it's my understanding that it doesn't matter how you log. You know, you can keep it on Excel, in a notebook, whatever you want, but it has to be contemporaneous, meaning you can't do it, at your IRS notice when it says you're getting audited. You can't like throw your logbook together. It has to be reasonable. You know, are those two things correct?
Correct. Yep. Both those things are correct. So the log itself doesn't matter. As long as you have the property name or address, the date, how much time you spent, and what you did on that log, that's fine. So that's what you're doing. And then the reasonableness thing is that there's court cases where the court will examine like emails. So there's one in particular where they walked through the taxpayer's time log. And they were like, yeah, I spent an hour on this email, hour on that email. And then they pull the email up and it's like a one sentence, you know, email. And so the tax court's like, I don't believe you, right? So this is really important to be as accurate as possible when you're recording your time. So we recommend that you do it on a daily or a weekly basis. Definitely not when you're getting audited, because that's where all the issues will start popping up.
Copy that.
Well, we're used to logging stuff because we log our flight hours right after we end our flights, right? Every pilot.
Right. And so my second question there was, how many properties would you say, you know, ballpark, would someone have to own physical rental properties in order to reasonably start qualifying for this? Is one property probably not enough? Two, is it three? What are your thoughts on that? And I suppose it depends on the type and the size and all that sort of stuff, but give us a ballpark there.
Yeah, it really depends. It really depends, like you said, on the type and on the size. There's not a bright line test for it. There are tax court cases where taxpayers have only had like one or two rentals. There's one in particular where the taxpayer had a three-unit property, and it was kind of in a shoddy part of town, but that was their only rental. And they visited it daily to kick homeless people off of the grounds and to clean it all up. So every single day, right? The IRS audited the taxpayer and basically was like, there's no way that this qualifies, but the tax court sided with the taxpayer, saying, "You know, yeah, you spent a significant amount of time on your one three in a property." There have also been cases where there's one in particular where a taxpayer had, I believe, eight or nine rentals, and didn't spend a ton of time in them, but put it all on the time log that she did, and then when they compared the time log to credit card statements, they realized that she was saying she was at the rental property, but her credit card statements were saying that she was like in London traveling. So really, it's hard to answer that question. I would definitely say the more properties that you have, the easier it's going to be to substantiate it. So it's less about the number of properties that qualify, and it's going to be more about, like you said, the type of property. You know, if it's a single family home and you've got professional management on it, or even a property manager, then that's going to be super hard to substantiate. If you're self-managing, it becomes a little bit easier. If you're managing bigger properties, a little bit easier to substantiate. If you're managing like, you know, mobile home parks, it's going to be a little bit easier. Because basically what you're thinking about with real estate professional status is, in general, how hard is this thing to manage on an ongoing basis? And you also have to kind of consider the distance that the property is from you to you from your home, right? Like we have clients that...
Because you can't count the travel, right? So if you're thinking, oh, I'm going to buy something six time zones away,
right,
I'm out all the time I spend sitting on an airplane. No, you can't do that, right?
Right. And you know, the weird thing is about the travel too, is you can expense the travel as a business expense, but it's not going to count as real estate professional status hours. And that's like, that always trips everybody up. But yeah, like if you're, not only can you not count the travel, but also when the property is far away, the IRS starts asking, well, who's actually managing the property? And now you start to lose points in the credibility arena. So in general, the more properties you have, the better. The bigger they are, the better. The closer they are, the better. And if you self-manage, the better.
Incredible. All right. So what sort of activities count as real estate professional? Because not just property management counts, right? You could be, you know, doing floors, doing tiling. You could be a real estate agent, right?
Correct. Yeah. So let's talk about being a landlord first, and then we can talk about the other real property trades of businesses. So when you're a landlord, if you are self-managing, then it's all like the property management related time that's going to count for real estate professional status. So it's like, you know, leasing the property, communicating with tenants, maintenance, repairs, even managing some of those contractors that might come out. It's not going to be like education and research and reviewing reports, doing the bookkeeping, all that type of time is not going to count unless you're the one that's like really managing the property. So that's kind of always where we start there. But in terms of other businesses, there's 11 real property trades or businesses that you could be involved in to count hours towards real estate professional status. Being a real estate agent is one of them. So if you're buying, if you're showing homes, all that time's going to count. If you're developing or redeveloping, like flipping properties, all that time's going to count as well. But it is kind of nuanced, right? Because like an HVAC contractor, their time's not going to count. And that sounds weird, but that's true. A mortgage broker, their time's not going to count. Painters, even, their time's not going to count. Like if that's your trade, you got to be really careful and aware of these rules because they're kind of nuanced in how they work. But in general, if you are like, if you're fixing up properties, if you're brokering properties, if you are managing your own rentals, all that time's going to count for real estate professional status.
And here is the kicker. If you're married and your spouse is one of these things, the jackpot bell should be going off in your head right now, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or if she isn't doing one of those things, or they could be doing those things. And then all of a sudden you've got some more magic to happen. So
yeah, because if one spouse qualifies, then you both qualify. So anyway.
And a little tangent about that. I mean, like if your spouse is looking for employment and they are deciding between, you know, some random $25 an hour job, whatever, doing this, or some random real estate job doing that that pays the same, and one gives the break and one doesn't give the break, that could be hundreds of thousands of dollars in tax breaks.
Right.
So maybe think strategically. Like, of course, enjoyment of what you do day to day is critical. But we're also, if it's to make money and to save money, because it's not always about what you make, it's about what you keep, that could be a huge strategic swing in the right direction. So make sure that, you know, if you're thinking about, your spouse is thinking about going back into employment, that might be a strategic move.
Yeah, you're right on the money there, Ryan. And it's a really good point, because if they can stay, if you can eliminate your income or wipe out a lot of it, the actual tax savings that come from that might be more than enough than going out and getting another set of income. So it's really important to analyze that. But the other thing too that that we always start with our clients, like typically the consulting that we do, the tax planning that we do, is a new client comes on and they're like, I've got to eliminate my income. I hate paying taxes. And it's typically the high income earner spouse that's initiating the entire conversation. And so then we get to, well, you can't qualify, but your spouse can qualify based on what you've said. And they're like, great, I'm going to make my spouse qualify. And they're like, well, why don't we have a conversation with spouse first and try to figure out, like, does spouse even want to do this? So if you're listening to this and you're getting really excited, you know, there is work to be done on the relationship side, and I'm not an expert at that, but I will tell you that that you should spend some time there.
Yeah, I mean, it's 60, what does it equate to? About 60 hours a month, right, for it to hit the 750.
Yeah, it's like 15 hours a week. Yes,
yeah,
60 hours a month.
Yeah, so it's no small amount of time.
Yeah, but if you can get it, then again, right, my rentals, they move out of the passive bucket and they go into the non-passive bucket where my W-2 income is. And I mean, you know, every year that I buy a $300,000 rental, I'm probably going to get, I don't know, an $80,000, $90,000 tax loss, which is going to yield $20,000 in tax savings. So just extrapolate that out. How much can you buy in any one year?
Right.
That's gonna yield more and more tax savings for you.
And it's not only the physical properties you buy. If you qualify for real estate professional status, you will also be able to unlock syndication losses against your W-2, correct? So if you invest with us or you invest with Ryan, we give you, you know, $100,000. You invest $100,000, we give you a K-1 that shows you that you lost $50,000. You get to take that $50,000 negative K-1 and apply it against your W-2 as well.
And this gets nuanced. You are correct in certain situations. So the way that this works is there's something called a grouping election for your rentals or for any rental activity. So what would have to happen is I would have to qualify as a real estate professional, and then I would have to materially participate in my own rentals.
Yes.
And then I could make this grouping election that groups in all of my LP investments as well into the portfolio that I already materially participate in. So who wouldn't qualify for something like this? It's like a real estate agent. So if I'm a real estate agent and I show houses for 1,500 hours a year and that's all I do, I'm a real estate professional. But if I don't materially participate in my own rentals, then my syndication losses are still going to be passive. So that's kind of where it gets like a little nuanced. I always have to come back to my rentals. I can flip houses, develop, build, be a real estate agent, but I always have to come back to my rentals and make sure that I hit the material participation test, and then I can group in my LP investments as well.
And this is really critical because, you know, when you think about all these nuances, right, this show is meant to educate and inform and inspire and give you tactics and strategies that you could deploy in your day-to-day, but there's nuances. And so Tate and I are not here to be the experts in all of these things, which is why we bring folks like Brandon Hall on the podcast, because he is an expert, but he doesn't know automatically every single nuance of every single person listening to this podcast right now. So what you need to do is you need to probably take the first step, and we're going to send you a copy of Brandon's ebook on becoming a real estate passive investor. If you go to ask@passiveincomepilots.com, we can send you that. We're also going to send you the top five things that that pilots can do to save taxes. Brandon has worked with us to kind of do that. And then if you're looking for a CPA, if you're looking for somebody that knows this stuff inside and out, Brandon is the guy to know that. So he's going to take the time to work with you on your personal tax situation and your personal tax strategy and help you do these types of things, these groupings. And, you know, my spouse is thinking about working and, you know, she's thinking about doing this real estate professional thing and help you through these strategies and help you do your tax return. So I always joke, I call that the left and the right brain of being a CPA, right? Right brain CPA, left brain CPA. One is really good at doing your tax return. The other is really good at crafting your strategy. And what you want is a firm like Brandon's who does both, right? They actually have the strategy side of the brain and they have the, I can actually file your 1065s, your K1s, your 1040s, whatever it might be. They can actually do that kind of stuff too. So that's why we were excited to bring you on and talk through all this stuff. So
yeah, I appreciate that. And anybody listening, if you read that book that Ryan just talked about, you know, I wrote that book in response to, it was like during COVID, we had a ton of people hitting our web forms for like new consultations. And everybody was like, just had bad information on how to qualify as a real estate professional. Like people were like, well, my buddy up the street's qualifying, so I'm going to qualify too. Like, it's not quite how it works. So I wrote that in response to this, just so that I could like consolidate all the information that I was talking about into one spot, but also provide a ton of citations so that people could like not even just trust my word, but actually go and look at it themselves if they really wanted to. But what it's kind of turned into is this guide that you can read. I've broken it down for the layman, so you don't have to be a tax pro to read it. And the idea is that you become just a little bit more sophisticated with your conversations with your own accountant.
Right.
Because what I've found in the marketplace is accountants, even if they know Section 469, they know like 90% of real estate professional status. And it's all the nuances that we have kind of talked about, right? There's a ton of these little nuances. And that'll get you there most of the time. But it's that last 10% that can be pretty scary if you screw it up. So I want you, anybody listening, to just spend a little, if you want to qualify as a real estate professional, spend a little bit of time educating yourself on it and just start asking questions to your own accountant. Make sure that they're doing it right, because just because you hire a CPA or EA or tax pro doesn't mean that they are recording this correctly for you on your tax returns.
That's so good.
I love that you said that, because sometimes early, I mean, I think I've been through like my own fault or another. I've been through a lot of different CPAs. You know, as my business has grown, maybe they couldn't keep up with the thousands of K1s, or maybe my tax strategy has become more complex. And so I've moved on from doing it in TurboTax to H&R Block to, you know, a local CPA to a real estate professional to a big major top 10 firm. And, you know, that might not be meet your perfect situation, but I think what you're saying about educating yourself and knowing a little bit, not being an expert, but enough to be dangerous. So at least you can kind of say to your CPA what your end state goal is. My end state goal is to engage my spouse, engage with my spouse in real estate activities that produces a tax efficient outcome. And if your CPA goes, got it, right? You're not claiming to be an expert. You're just saying, hey, I want a tax efficient outcome leveraging real estate activities. That should be enough for your CPA to put you on the tracks. If not, you're probably talking to the wrong CPA.
Yeah.
Because they're not putting you on the right path, right? So you want to make sure you're just talking to somebody that is familiar with this track, and just any old CPA might not be that person. And so anyway, I think that's so important, the education piece, and then just kind of giving the end state expectation and the vision of what you're trying to accomplish as a husband and wife, or as an airline pilot trying to save money on taxes. So
not to completely dogpile on this, but yeah, it like education and network, right? Your network is your net worth. This is what Ryan and I are trying to shortcut everyone's, learning cycle here. And you gotta meet your CPA halfway. You gotta learn, so that you can have an intelligent conversation with them and strategize, right?
And I think it's important to just call out that when you sign your tax returns, you are taking responsibility for everything in the tax returns. So if you're later audited and you lose the position, you might be able to go after the CPA and the E&O insurance, but there's a likelihood that you probably won't. And there's a likelihood that you probably won't be able to get the penalties removed, because even though you relied on a CPA, the court or the IRS is going to say, yeah, but you're investing in real estate. You're a sophisticated person. You should have known. So know that that's the position that they're going to take. So to go into these positions, these tax decisions, by asking questions. One of my favorite questions to ask vendors that I use personally is, where can this go wrong? Like, what are the things that I'm not aware of here? How would the IRS view this for me? Like, I'm a pilot. I've got a W-2 income. What is the IRS going to think? Are they going to audit me for that? Yeah, they might. Okay, well then, what would they be looking for? And where could this go wrong? Like, where am I going to screw this up? Understand the other perspective, the IRS's perspective, and that'll help you build a better position that you can defend. But don't get the confirmation bias. Don't get FOMO. Don't get like, you can go and call up 5 CPAs and you could say, hey, I work full time. I work 2,000 hours a year. I make $1 million a year. I'm going to be a real estate professional this year. And you call 5 CPAs, I guarantee you 2 of them will say, yeah, we'll do that for you. And they're putting you in a bad spot. So you have to know, you have to educate yourself on this.
Yeah. One thing I'll also say to that is like the Dunning-Kruger effect is real. So if you're just learning about this, you're at the peak of Mount Stupid. So you know enough to be dangerous. And what you'll realize as you do this, you really didn't know anything. So it's kind of like that passenger after why is my flight delayed? And the passenger comes up and shows you a picture of my weather radar, and they say there's no storm at the destination. I don't know why this is delayed for weather. And as a pilot, you just kind of roll your eyes and you say, this person has no idea what they're talking about. That's kind of what we sound like as pilots when we go to our CPAs and say, I listened to this podcast and it said I could do all these things. And the CPA just kind of eye rolls and says, yeah, here we go again, right? So come into it with an open mind, listen to what your CPA says. They're the expert, right? But also trust but verify. The passenger does deserve that explanation sometimes of, hey, the storm is over here and the routes are such that whatever. But at the end of the day, like, they know what they're doing and there's a system and a process in place. But just make sure you're on the right airplane with the right pilots and the right crew that can actually get you safely to where you're going. And that's kind of the point we're making is, educate yourself, know enough to be dangerous. Learn what strategies are out there, but make sure you're with the right CPA. So
let's quickly talk about material participation, because the 750 hours, I think everybody stops there and they go, okay, I did my 750. Now I'm a real estate professional, right? So the 750, one person has to do. The 500 of material participation, you can split with a spouse. Can you just touch on that briefly?
Yeah. So when you qualify as a real estate professional, well, let's just talk about material participation first. qualifying as a real estate professional doesn't do anything for you if you don't have material participation in your rentals. And that's the example I was kind of using. If I'm a real estate agent and I work 1,500 hours, I'm a real estate professional. But if I don't also materially participate in my rentals, then my rentals are still passive, even though I qualify as a real estate professional. So it doesn't actually help me. So I have to meet one of the 7 material participation tests. Typically, we encourage people to go after the 500-hour test because once you hit it, you're good. So the 500-hour test, like if I'm managing my rentals, I can be working on my material participation and real estate professional status hours at the same time. But if I'm like a real estate agent, I just have to remember to come back and work on my rentals to hit that 500-hour test. But to your point, if you're married and you file a joint tax return, if one of you qualifies as a real estate professional, you've got a real estate professional status tax return. That's the beauty of this. However, here's how it works. One person has to meet the real estate professional status test totally by themselves. So either me or my spouse. They have to meet the 750 hours and more time spent in real estate than anywhere else. They have to meet that completely on their own. But when it comes to material participation, we can split our time. We can count both of our hours. So like, let's say that my spouse is a real estate agent and she works 1,500 hours a year. So she's a real estate professional. But let's say she hates the rentals and I manage all the rentals. She can count my material participation hours. So now she's a real estate professional and she's counting my material participation hours. And now we've got material participation in our rentals. That's kind of how that works.
So how do, you know, I mean, because this is complex and nuanced, and most, the biggest complaint that I get is, you know, my CPA just files my taxes. There's no forward-looking strategy. How much coaching can someone reasonably expect, when it comes to their personal situation? From a firm like yours, or is there any other place that they can go to learn about this more so that they can craft their own strategy?
I think the good CPA firms are transitioning more into that advisory space, that kind of like planning space. So more of that coaching is kind of coming out over time. But I think that if you are buying rental real estate, you should get educated on this sooner rather than later. So what you can DIY it as much as you want to, but all the nuances is where you're going to trip up, and that's where you rely on the expertise. So it just kind of depends. But I would say sooner rather than later, because your mistakes will compound if you don't.
Right.
And if you're not getting that from your current accountant, I always say, like, give your current accountant a try. Don't get me wrong. Like, I would love for you to come work with us, but give your current accountant a try. Like, there's a relationship there. They understand what's going on, you know, with your different income streams. And you give it a try by saying, hey, I would like some advice on this topic. Here are my questions, and see what they say. But if they kind of brush you off, or if they're like, I have to go research it, and they're not able to kind of like coach you there, then you might want to consider getting a second opinion, not necessarily like switching, but getting a second opinion, or switching to another firm that is going to provide you that consultation on an ongoing basis.
So important.
Yeah. I loved how you said, give your current CPA a chance. Cause I think too often people say, oh, my CPA just doesn't know anything about this. And it's like, well, you haven't asked them the right questions. Right. So like, learn how to ask better questions, and then maybe your CPA is doing the right thing, but they just don't know what you're up to. So take the time and have that conversation. But if that conversation goes bad, then call Brandon.
Yeah. Well, so. And I'll say one more thing too, like consider the business model of not just CPAs, but any vendor you work with. So now any vendor I work with, I want to know how they get paid, and I don't need to know, like, you know, what's your profit and crap like that. But what I'm really asking is this going to be like a transactional relationship? Or is this going to be more advisory consultative? Am I going to have ability to call you? And the way that most accounting firms work, or most tax firms, is it's a transactional relationship. It's once a year tax prep. That's what you're paying for. You're not paying for the advice. So consider that too, with your own relationship. Maybe it's time to ask your accountant, hey, like, if I wanted to hop on 2 or 3 calls with you a year, can I pay you for that? Can I pay now for that so we can go ahead and get those scheduled? I think that'll be a big game changer if you're not currently getting any advice.
So good.
Yeah. And it's also good to like scope out what you're going to get charged when you call your CPA. Because I think some people find it surprising when they get a $300, $400, $500 bill in the mail. And it's like, what's this for? And it's like, well, because you talked to me for 3 hours and I charge by the hour. So, you know, I would understand like what you're getting and kind of the contractual relationship. It's important to establish that. Don't be surprised if you get a bill in the mail because you jack-jawed with your CPA for 3 hours about some type of advice. right? Because like they
don't charge and they don't want to talk to you.
Yeah, it goes both ways. I mean, you get what you pay for in this world, unfortunately, or fortunately for those. And it's like, you know, they're doing your tax return. That is a cost. And then you're getting advising. That's a cost. People's time is valuable. They could be doing something else when they're talking to you. They're not talking to you because they're your buddy. They're talking to you because it's a work relationship. So you should establish that open door of communication, right? If I'm going to talk to you, can I talk to you? Can I schedule times? How do I do that? How available are you? And what does that cost me in addition to doing my tax return?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the CPA industry is very old and tired. They use antiquated billing methods. It's actually my secondary goal here is to shake it all up and show a different model that can be used. But I mean, your experience is very common, unfortunately.
Yeah, I love your thought leadership on LinkedIn, Brandon, on just helping the new business world. Right? We could probably talk a whole hour about that, but you know, just kind of remote workers and where this is headed, and you know, just finding good employment. So if you're on LinkedIn, follow Brandon. He's great thought leadership if you're starting your own business as well. So,
well, Brandon, thank you so much for coming on. This has been excellent. We, as Ryan said, if you email ask@passiveincomepilots.com, we'll send you the ebook. And Brandon, thank you for everything. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.